least 30 Palestinian worshippers are wounded after Israeli forces attacked the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Muslims' third holiest site, for the fifth day in a row. The Arab League urges Israel to stop its ultra-nationalists from entering the sacred Muslim site of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Al-Quds. And a blow to the British Prime Minister's authority. Lawmakers order an investigation into Boris Johnson's so-called Partygate scandal. Thank you for joining us. Tensions across the occupied territories are getting worse by the hour, with Israeli forces stepping up their atrocities against worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. At least 30 Palestinians have been wounded by rubber bullets inside the mosque compound, which is besieged by Israeli forces. The victims sustained injuries in the head and the neck. One person was transferred to hospital with a rubber bullet to his back. Regime troops have been intensifying assaults on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, including the worshippers who congregate at the Al-Aqsa Mosque during the fasting month of Ramadan. Meanwhile, Palestinians have been launching operations to counter the Israeli violence. Over the past month, nearly two dozen Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank in a spate of retaliatory attacks and confrontations with Israeli forces. Earlier, we were joined by our Ramallah correspondent, Mona Kandil, who updated us on Israel's recent acts of violence in Al-Quds.
Well, we have to mention that it's for the fifth consecutive day Israeli settlers are raiding the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex with the protection of Israeli police officers immediately following the morning Fajr prayers. After Palestinians pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, Israeli forces storm and raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. They force the Palestinian worshippers out the complex in order to bring Israeli settlers and allow them to desecrate the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, like what happened today. According to Palestinian officials in the Al-Aqsa Mosque, today alone over 700 Jewish settlers have raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, of course protected by the Israeli forces.
The Arab League breaks its silence on the recent Israeli violation at Al-Aqsa. The League says Israel must stop restricting Muslims from worshipping there while allowing ultra-nationalist Jews to enter the sacred site. The organization says Israel has broken the status quo and is now allowing Jews to pray at the compound under the police protection. In a statement, the League called on Israel to stop such practice. It also warned that a flagrant affront to Muslim feelings risks a cycle of violence and threatens stability in the region and the world. The statement comes following an emergency meeting of the League in which member states discussed illegal Israeli policies in Al-Quds. Human rights activist Firas Najim says the Arab League statement does not bother Israel much, and the organization needs to take real action to punish the regime for its crimes.
This statement doesn't really do much. I mean, there's probably some pressures, from different nations, different organizations pushing on the Arab League to, declare something, say something, because, the attacks against the Palestinians is continuous and it's daily now. And every day, they're provoking the Palestinian worshippers, the women, the men, and they're shooting them with tear gas and, arresting people. The Arab League, I mean, what have they done? Why don't they impose sanctions? I mean, why don't they impose their own sanctions? Why don't they work on putting pressure on these Arab regimes to cut relations with Israel, to make Israel really feel that there is some kind of punishment for what they're doing. I mean, this, what is a statement going to do? Israel doesn't care about any statements. The United Nations has been issuing statements for many years without actual action against Israel, without actual severe sanctions or anything. And Israel feels like they have a green light to do and commit any crime or any violation.
In the run-up to International Quds Day, a UK-based rights group is calling on supporters of the Palestinian struggle to lift their voices in support and solidarity. The 2022 edition of the Fly the Flag for Palestine campaign is an opportunity to remind Palestinians living under occupation and in the diaspora that they are not alone. Amina Taylor has more.
Violence, oppression and desecration of holy sites. Just more of the Ramadan reminders that Palestinians continue to live under occupation and suffer daily injustices. More than ever, international solidarity, especially in an age of social media, is important. With the atrocities being committed against Palestinians, raising awareness and exhibiting support is more crucial than before. This year's Fly the Flag for Palestine campaign is giving millions across the world the opportunity to show solidarity by displaying a Palestinian flag in person or online.
If we are not able to stand up at this hour of need and be supportive to those Palestinians by holding a flag on our car, on our shops, on our homes, then what are we good for? And when are we going to do this? And I think what I have seen, ordinary people responding so fantastically. From Hyderabad,
India. In the lead up to the annual Al-Quds rally in the British capital, the global support for the campaign is in full swing.
Organizers are encouraging participation in this year's event, and taking part could not be more simple. First of all, please post your image or your footage online, encourage a few friends to do the same, and of course, use the hashtag.
As the global solidarity movement grows, so does the opposition, a fact not lost on pro-Palestine campaigners.
We got ministers coming and saying, they're going to refer us to the police for saying from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. It's outrageous. These are the same people that actually articulate that freedom of speech is absolute. And, they go on and on. What's wrong with any part of the world to be free? What's wrong with asking people to be free?
So organizers are urging you to do your part. Lift your voice in solidarity and fly the flag for Palestine. Amina Taylor, London.
Britain's Parliament has passed a motion that authorizes an investigation into potential lies told by the Prime Minister in the case of the COVID lockdown breaches.
The question is, as on the order papers, many of that opinion say aye.
Aye!
On the contrary, no. I think the ayes have it. The ayes have it.
Boris Johnson will now be the subject of a probe by the Parliament's Privileges Committee, which will begin work after the London police are through with their inquiries. The committee has the authority to sanction or suspend the Prime Minister if he is found guilty or misleading the Parliament. Earlier, Tory MPs scrambled to find a way to block or delay the inquiry with an amendment, but in an unexpected reversal, they pulled the amendment off the table. The British police have already fined Johnson for breaking pandemic rules by holding illegal gatherings, both at his office and residence, and the opposition keeps calling for his resignation over the so-called Partygate scandal. It's time now for our news review segment, where we take a look at one of our stories in a bit more detail. Germany has displaced hundreds of Afghan refugees to make room for the Ukrainians fleeing the conflict back home. The government says there was no alternative since Ukrainians, quote, needed a roof over their heads. The Afghan refugees say social workers came with eviction notices, giving them 24 hours to clear out their houses. The Berlin Refugee Council has expressed concern over the government's biased treatment of refugees in the past few months. Social workers have also voiced frustration over the treatment of Afghans as well as other West Asian and North African refugees in Germany. In 2021, some 12,000 Afghans arrived in Germany after the Taliban's takeover. Joining us for this edition of the News Review is Daniel Lazar, author and journalist from New York, and also Rodney Shakespeare, author and political commentator from London. Professor Shakespeare, allow me to start with you. What's the difference between a Ukrainian refugee fleeing violence and an Afghan asylum seeker also fleeing violence?
Probably it's the colour of their skin. The Western globalists are evil. The war in Ukraine, from which the refugees are coming, could be stopped now by a straight declaration that Ukraine will remain neutral, there'll be no movement of NATO to the east, and by saying there'll be implementation of the Minsk Accords. You then got, they're not doing that because they're in the game of trying to destroy Russia, promote Russia, ultimately because they want to get at China. And then when you get these refugees coming in, you're getting a straight race. The Afghan refugees are heavily traumatized and they're insecure and they're now being put into another traumatic situation. And then on top of this, the Western globalists are then going to inflict upon the European populations what are going to be astonishing price rises in gas, energy, and in food prices and other things. You're looking a sort of weird evil manifesting itself in all sorts of ways.
Professor, thank you. Daniel, welcome. Daniel, what do you make of this two-faced policy by Germany towards asylum seekers?
I agree with absolutely everything Professor Shakespeare said. I would only add that the Afghan refugees represent an American defeat, and therefore Germany holds the Afghans responsible, Germany being a dutiful servant of the American imperial masters, and that the NATO is still hoping to win the war in the Ukraine, and so therefore it regards the Ukrainian refugees as somehow more deserving of reward. That's the only difference. But and I would also second Professor Shakespeare in saying that this NATO war is imposing huge costs on Europe, including Germany, in the form of refugees. Refugees are not cheap. They require a lot of money to take care of, and it's a cost that the United States is very happily shunting off onto Germany. So it's outrageous, all around.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for your thoughts and your time. Let me thank our guests for their contribution. Daniel Lazar is an author and journalist joining us from New York, and Rodney Shakespeare, author and political commentator, joining us live also from the British capital, London. That brings an end to another edition of the News Review. In other news, huge explosions yet again rock Afghanistan, leaving dozens of casualties in several major cities, including the capital, Kabul. A powerful bomb blast ripped through a Shia mosque in the northern city of Mazar-e-Sharif, killing over 30 people. The bombing, which targeted a congregation of worshippers, also left dozens injured, many of whom are now in critical condition. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility for the bomb attack. The targeted mosque is one of the biggest places of worship frequented by the Hazara minority group.
The incident that occurred inside the Sadr Khan Mosque of Mazar Sharif was really heartbreaking. I was at the market and arrived to the site as fast as I could. Unfortunately, the number of casualties is very high.
The explosion left so many deaths and injuries behind. People have come to donate blood. The Taliban did not cooperate the way they should. The victims of this incident are so many. We urge the Islamic Emirate to pay more attention to the security of the people. How long will such incidents continue?
Iran has condemned the bombing, noting that targeting fasting worshippers in the holy month of Ramadan is an abhorrent act of terror. Meanwhile, the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Afghanistan has called for an investigation into, quote, systematic targeted attacks on crowded mosques and schools. In Pakistan, Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif has also condemned the, quote, heinous act of violence in Mazar-e-Sharif. Several other Afghan cities were also rocked by explosions on Thursday. In the city of Kunduz, authorities say a blast left at least 4 people dead and 18 wounded. A roadside bomb went off in a Shia neighborhood in western Kabul, injuring 2 children. The Taliban have condemned the attacks, pledging to bring the perpetrators to justice. The explosions come 2 days after a twin bombing in Kabul killed 6 people. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Imam Ali, peace upon him, the barometer of belief. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam everybody, and heartfelt condolences to you all on the start of the morning days of Blessed Ramadan. Today, the 19th of Ramadan, is that tragic day in history when the barometer of belief and the supreme symbol of justice was fatally wounded while engrossed in the morning ritual prayer. Stay with us for a special feature in this regard. As a matter of fact, the grand man, after spending the first of the three grand nights of Qadr in prayer and worship, was struck in the Grand Mosque of Kufa by the poisoned sword of the renegade Abdurrahman ibn Muljam Muradi. Yet, despite the severity of the wound, the first phrase that came to the lips of the commander of the faithful was Fosto Varabul Ka'be. It means, by the Lord of the Ka'be, I have succeeded. Let us try to present you a glimpse of the exemplary life of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, the dearest ward, cousin, son-in-law, and divinely designated vicegerent of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Imam Ali, peace upon him, kept his pledge with God Almighty by tasting the elixir of martyrdom and departing in dignified manner from the mortal world. As the Noble Quran says in Ayah 23 of Surah Ahzab, among the believers are men who fulfill what they pledge unto Allah. Of them, some have fulfilled their pledge, and of them are some who still wait, and they have not changed in the least. Once during his discourse from the pulpit of the Grand Mosque of Kufa, when Imam Ali, peace upon him, was asked to explain this particular ayah, he replied, this ayah was revealed in my honor and that of my uncle Hamza and my cousin Ubayd ibn Harith. The Imam went on to say how the two had fulfilled their pledge with Allah by attaining martyrdom, Ubayd ibn Harith in the Battle of Badr and Hamza in the Battle of Uhud. As for myself, added Imam Ali, peace upon him, I am awaiting a most painful death when this, pointing to his beard, shall be drenched from the blood of this, pointing it to his head, and have never changed the least. Imam Ali, peace upon him, said his source of information on the manner of fulfillment of his own pledge to Allah in such a tragic way, or, in other words, his martyrdom, was his cousin and father-in-law, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, in whose lap he had been raised ever since a child. For further details, our listeners could refer to the works of both Sunni and Shia Muslim scholars, including Mustadrak as-Sahihain of Hakim Nishaburi and the exegesis of the Noble Quran, Tafsir Majma'ul Bayan of Tabarsi. We are commemorating these days the anniversary of the tragic event that ended the only instance in history of the model government of justice. Imam Ali, peace upon him, true to his pledge to Allah, attained immortal martyrdom 2 days later on the 21st of the month of fasting in 40 AH, in the very manner that a weak pink prophet, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, had prophesied decades earlier at the onset of a fasting Ramadan with the following words, O Ali, I weep for that which will befall you in this month, visualizing to be in your place when you will be praying to your Lord, and the most wicked person of all times, like the one who chopped off the feet of the camel of Thamud, that was proof of Prophet Saleh's divine mission, will strike you on your head, and your beard will be dyed in blood. So fatal was the blow on the morning of 19th of Ramazan from the poisoned sword of that most wicked of the wicked persons. Abdul Rahman ibn Muljam, that the Islamic Ummah has still not recovered till this day from its disastrous effect, despite the passing of over a millennium and almost four centuries. The Muslims are still in a state of bewilderment because of their failure to heed the words of the person regarding whom the Prophet had said, "I am the city of knowledge and Ali is its gateway." In other words, in order to properly understand the Sunnah and Sirah, or the behavior and practice, as well as the genuine Islamic message of the Almighty's last messenger to mankind, we have no other choice but to approach him through the proper channel. That is, through Imam Ali, peace upon him, regarding whose pivotal position in Islam the Prophet had also said, "If there was no Ali, peace upon him, it would have been impossible to identify true believers after me." We are commemorating the anniversary of the tragic days that befell the leader of the pious, and this should awaken our conscience to the undeniable facts. On being struck the fatal blow that fulfilled his pledge to Allah, Imam Ali, peace upon him, said in a calm and composed manner, "Fustu wa Rabbul Ka'ba," which means, "By the Lord of the Ka'ba, I have succeeded." There are immortal lessons to be learned, not just from these words and other discourses of the Imam, but from all his actions and deeds spread over 63 glorious years. Since the day he was born in the holiest of holies, that is, God's symbolic house, the Ka'ba, and departed from the world after being struck the fatal blow on his head while in prostration to the Almighty in the Grand Mosque of Kufa, also a house of God. Imam Ali, peace upon him, was about to die, yet he was as calm and confident of the path ahead as he was on the day he volunteered to sleep on the Prophet's bed that fateful night of the Hijra 40 years ago, when assassins hovered around the abode of divine revelation and it was vital for his cousin to migrate undetected towards Medina. The bezels of wisdom bequeathed to humanity by the man who transcends history and historical developments are outside the scope of this brief radio program, which we would like to end with food for thought by presenting you two passages mentioned as letter number 47 in the famous book Nahjul Balagha from his last will on the deathbed. "I advise you to fear Allah. Do not go after this vicious world, though it may try to entice you. Do not seek it, though it may seek you, and do not grieve over and pine for things which this world refuses you. Let the eternal reward and blessings of Allah be the prompting factors for all that you say and do. Be an enemy of tyrants and oppressors, and be a friend and helper of those who are oppressed and tyrannized. Develop mutual liking, friendship, and love, and help one another. Take care that you do not spurn and treat one another badly and unsympathetically. Exhort people to do good and abstain them from evil. Otherwise, the vicious and the wicked will be your overlords, and if you willingly allow such persons to be your rulers, then your prayers will not be heard by Allah."
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special.
There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطيبين الطاهرين اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners, welcome to your own program, A Muslim Lady, where we have been discussing so many various important issues regarding Muslim Lady. I hope you have enjoyed all our discussions, and I also hope you will benefit from today's discussions. I am Farman Ali Masumi, and with me in our studios, my wife, Raldia Batul Najafi.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
So in our previous episode, we talked about the very important quality of hijab in a Muslim society, you know, to show her firmness.
Exactly.
But when it comes to family, Islam says she has to be very polite, humble, soft-spoken. But unfortunately, in nowadays, we see practically it is totally different. Ladies, unfortunately, go to this when they come in the society, they are very happy, soft-spoken.
Because society and media has just stolen them. You know, deceive them, you know, deceive in that sense that, you know, they have shown that glamour and they are giving a very artificial respect, you know, to her, appreciation to her. So therefore, sometimes very easily they get deceived and they get attracted towards the society's pressure.
So when
lovely discussion, very, very healthy discussion we have. And I'm very thankful to our Prophet that Prophet has taught us a beautiful, amazing, like qualities about Muslim ladies. Yeah,
we have so many beautiful treasures, and Alhamdulillah, we have so many books also, so many riwayat, and our great scholars, they have done such hard work to make these riwayat reach us.
Exactly.
Great scholars like Kulaini, like Sheikh Saduq, Sheikh Mufid, Sheikh
Tusi. So because of them, you know, all because of their sacrifices, today we are so rich. And we have all these treasures of sayings of Ma'sumin.
This is famous hadith that midadul ulama'i afdalu min dima'i shuhada, that the ink of the scholars is better than the blood of a martyr.
Indeed.
So we were talking about these qualities of a Muslim lady, that a Muslim society expects from a Muslim lady. There is another thing, that when she intermingles, when she comes in the society, she has to take care of some other things. For example, keeping the distance between non-mahram and herself, wherever she works and or wherever she goes. So she should be cautious about these things also. We are saying, or Islam also has said, that if ladies, they are allowed to come in the society, work for the society, help, you know, to their own societies, it means they should come and play their role, but with some conditions. And one of the conditions is to keep the distance with non-mahram, especially a working Muslim lady. When she's supposed to cover, you know, wear hijab and cover her body with decent clothing, in talking and keeping the distance is also very important. If she is covering her body and wearing hijab, but while talking to non-mahram, she is very polite. If she is not taking care of those boundaries and limits, again, this can lead to so many problems.
Exactly. Yeah, therefore our Prophet, he said, Al-Aziza. Yeah. She has to be sometimes very, very firm, not definitely rude. Yeah.
So we are going to have a short break. Please, listeners, don't go away. Stay tuned. Inshallah, we'll come back soon.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Once Amir al-Mu'minin al-Islam was talking to the Kufis, she was saying that, I have heard your ladies, when your ladies walk on the way, their bodies touch to non-mahram's bodies, which is very, very immoral or indecent. So Imam Ali says, do you not feel shame? It shows that these things are very important. While walking, while working, while sitting, we should always keep that certain distance.
Yeah, therefore, you know, I always take the very strict rulings of modesty, which Muslim society has this expectation from Muslim lady. I take it in a very positive way that what Muslim society says, oh, woman, you should be active, come, you know, but come with this certain conditions. And when you have the ruling of hijab and modesty, that means you have to come out from the house. Yeah. You know, you have to be like, you are allowed to be active, to be social. You know, socializing is important.
Definitely.
Yeah.
In the Holy Quran also, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, لِلْرِجَالِ نَصِيبٌ مِمَّا اكْتَسَبُوا وَلِلنِّسَاءِ نَصِيبٌ مِمَّا اكْتَسَبْنَا. It is very famous.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, some radical society, radical Muslim societies, they say women are not allowed to work.
What is the translation of this ayah?
This ayah says, whatever men earn, it belongs to them, and whatever women earn, it belongs to them. It not only shows that they can work, but also it shows that whatever they work and whatever they earn, it belongs to them. They become the owner, the malik of whatever they earn.
Yeah.
It means they have, you know, complete freedom. They have this right of earning and doing whatever business they want to do. So it is not like this, that whatever they earn belongs to their husbands or their fathers. No, they have complete freedom in this.
No doubt. From this verse. They are independent, yeah.
Independent, yeah. A Muslim society expects from a Muslim lady to have a strong self-building characteristic and a strong behavior in the society.
And very influential, you know.
Influential, yeah.
Her perspective, her religion, her, you know, opinion has so much weight and value in the Muslim society. So Muslim society never says that you have to be dependent on your father, brother, or husband. No way. You know, like all the teachings of Quran is equally for women too, and she is responsible, you know, independently about her actions, her ibadat, her economically, her earnings, and her, you know, service towards the society too. So that is something really, really
but definitely
amazing.
Definitely, again, with some conditions.
Yeah.
And again, Islam, the Islam's first priority towards women is her family, her house. That's why Islam, as this beautiful hadith, so many times we have shared with our dear listeners, that jihadul mar'i Husnut Taba'ul. Husnut, in Husnut Taba'ul comes everything. Good behavior, you know, upbringing your children in a nice way according to Islamic rulings, your behavior with your father, your family members, your, you know, mother-in-law, father-in-law, with your husband. All these things come under the one single sentence, Husnut Taba'ul. Good behavior towards your
husband and towards your family and in-laws, which is the big task for her.
Another very important issue is friendship with non-mahram. This is a very big issue. Maybe we have talked about it in brief, but we want to focus on it and go into the details because this is a very important issue. Sometimes maybe some people say that Islam is very strict, you know. Islam does not want women to, you know, feel happy or, you know, enjoy themselves. No, Islam says like men can enjoy their life, they have freedom. Women also have freedom. They can enjoy their themselves also, but within some limits. And these limits are for a very good reason. And that reason is the tranquility, the peace, the calmness in our society, in our families. Because if you have that calmness and peace and tranquility in your family, within your family, then it will show in your society. So Islam has these limits not only for women, for men also. Men also not allowed to do friendship with non-mahram ladies and women.
Can you believe it? Imam Ali alayhi salam, he never used to start talking to young girls. And he knows that saying salam, greeting, it has so much reward. But he would say, I'm just doing this precaution. I'm taking this precaution that maybe, you know, by greeting a young namahram girl, you know, that greeting starts towards some non-permitted conversation. So he is just stopping himself. So he's Imamul Muttaqeen, you know, the leader of pious people. So much piety we can see in a beautiful seerah of Amir al-Mumineen alayhi salam.
Even in this ayah, the verse of Holy Quran also say, Muhsanatin غَيْرُ مُصَافِحَاتٍ وَلَا مُتَّخِذَاتِ أَخْدَانٍ. They do not make friendship with non-mahram.
I know in Quran two times Allah has mentioned about this friendship between opposite sex. So it's something really nice that Islam knows from beginning. You know, it's something not new. So Islam says, you are not allowed to have friendship, you know, like too much, you know, relax, have conversation with opposite sex,
Unfortunately, it is very common. It is very normal. So nobody is conscious about these things. They say talking to, you know, a female and male is a very normal thing. When you look from a bird's view, you can see that it has a very good reason. Why should we not intermingle with non-mahram ladies or non-mahram men? All these are because of our own social health, our moral health, our self-building also. If we have limited relationship, definitely that relationship lasts longer. It has more meaning. It has more pleasure for us. Whereas if you have a lot of relations, illegal relations, or, you know, socially and friendships, so many, then your own relationship with your family weakens, becomes very weak, and you do not get that pleasure from those relationships. Again, we are coming to end of this program. Thank you so much for being with us. I myself, truly, I benefit a lot from these beautiful riwayat and verses of the Holy Quran.
Yeah.
I hope our dear listeners also do so. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Central Intelligence Agency has secretly been running mass surveillance operations to collect data on Americans, according to a newly published letter written by Senators Ron Wyden and Martin Heinrich. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by John Miltimore Ryder. This article is published under the heading Six Things We Know About the CIA's Secret Mass Surveillance Program. Here's the story. The Central Intelligence Agency has secretly been running mass surveillance operations to collect data on Americans, according to a newly published letter written by Senators Ron Wyden and Martin Heinrich. Wyden and Heinrich, both members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, wrote the letter in April 2021, and the letter was partly declassified recently. In the letter, Wyden and Heinrich called on the CIA to inform the public about the data collection program, calling for full transparency. This declassification is urgent, the senators wrote. The CIA responded to the allegations in a statement published by the Wall Street Journal. CIA recognizes and takes very seriously our obligation to respect the privacy and civil liberties of U.S. persons in the conduct of our vital national security mission and conducts our activities, including collection activities, in compliance with U.S. law, Executive Order 12,333, and our Attorney General guidelines, said Christy Scott, the agency's privacy and civil liberties officer, adding, CIA is committed to transparency consistent with obligation to protect intelligence sources and methods. The allegations from Wyden and Heinrich are serious, but the extent of the danger and severity is clouded by several factors, not the least of which is the fact that the letter is highly redacted. Here are a few important takeaways. Number one, laws prohibit CIA spying on Americans. As Politico noted, the CIA is largely prohibited by law from engaging in domestic spying, which makes the revelations troubling. But as the Wall Street Journal reports at times, intelligence agencies have found ways to circumvent these prohibitions, noting that some U.S. intelligence programs collect broad streams of internet or telephone data in a way that can scoop up information on Americans, such as when someone is communicating with a target of surveillance who lives overseas. This is known as incidental collection, and it's an issue lawmakers in both parties have flagged as a violation of civil liberties and personal privacy. Number two, the nature of the surveillance is unclear. Several publications have pointed out that the nature of the surveillance isn't really clear. Yet the language in the redacted letter suggests the program involves non-traditional surveillance, noting data collection is done in bulk and uses backdoor searches of Americans, the same issue that has generated bipartisan concern in the FISA context. As the ACLU says, this implies the spy agency may be vacuuming up vast amounts of information to spy on Americans and storing it indefinitely. Number three, the surveillance is warrantless. While the nature of the surveillance is murky, Senators Wyden and Heinrich make one thing clear. The information being collected is warrantless, meaning the data are being scooped up without a warrant. This directly violates the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which states the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures, shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. And number four, the program appears to be unlawful. While what constitutes spying is debatable, but Wyden and Heinrich suggest that the program may have exceeded its lawful bounds. While the senators don't use the words unlawful or illegal, they suggest the program may be just that, noting it falls entirely outside the statutory framework that Congress and the public believe govern this collection. What the precise statutory framework isn't spelled out here, but it's safe to say that Wyden believes that the CIA is acting outside that of a scope. Number 5, the CIA is acting without oversight. While there has been a great deal of discussion on the idea that the FBI's FISA warrant process is broken, it's worth noting that at least that program had some judicial oversight, weak as it often was. Wyden and Heinrich suggest this is not the case with CIA's data collection program, which they say operates without any of the judicial, congressional, or even executive branch oversight that comes from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. At number 6, this isn't Wyden's first dust-up with CIA. Finally, it's worth noting that this is not the first time Wyden has clashed with the CIA over rogue operations. In 2016, the senator from Oregon had a heated exchange with then CIA Director John Brennan over the CIA's improper search of Senate files, including the unauthorized search of the emails of Senate staffers investigating the CIA's use of torture in the so-called War on Terror. Brennan denied the CIA's actions were improper, even though both a CIA inspector general and a review board appointed by Brennan himself conceded the search resulted in an appropriate access to the Senate's work product, prompting a sharp rebuke from Wyden. In 2013, Wyden also asked Director of National Intelligence James Clapper if the NSA collected any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans. Clapper responded, "No, sir, not wittingly." It was later revealed the NSA was in fact collecting metadata on millions of law-abiding Americans without warrants. Many thinkers have written about the dangers of bureaucracy, a system in which important decisions are made not only by individuals or even elected representatives, but state officials. The famed writer and traveler Alexei D. Togavey saw bureaucracy as the Achilles heel of modern democracy. A century later, the great economist Ludwig von Mises wrote an entire book about its nature and evils, bureaucracy. The tentacles of the U.S. bureaucratic state do not reach as far as those of states in the 20th century, the period in which Arendt wrote, but as early as the 1930s, government reports have warned about a headless fourth branch of the government responsible to no one. That was more than 80 years ago. Now, there is a secret CIA program that has been spying on Americans free from any kind of oversight for an undetermined length of time. This sounds just a bit like the terror Arendt described. What happens next, however, is unclear. The list of U.S. intelligence scandals and improper programs has grown lengthy in recent years, but accountability has been elusive. We will see if this time is any different.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.